Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Beiser from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another great episode of the Perceptive Podcast, where we examine the art and science of games. As of this night, as we're recording, we got hit by a massive storm. James is unfortunately not able to make it. I was just barely able to get on tonight. It seems like we're getting hit by more and more storms, but the storm couldn't stop us from having a great discussion. My guest tonight is from the studio Jiraiya Technology. I'm pretty sure I just mispronounced that, and I apologize. He has working on the game Concealed Intent for the last few years, which is a simultaneous turn-based strategy game. And he's here tonight to talk a little bit about the design, as well as the process of making it. So, please welcome to the cast, Charles.
Thank you, and hello everyone.
Charles, it's a pleasure to have you on tonight. I know you're currently located in Malaysia, is that right?
Yes, I'm in Kuala Lumpur right now. It's early morning, well, not that early, 9 a.m. in Kuala Lumpur right now.
Yeah, and it's about 9:30 at night over here on the east coast of the United States. Like I said, I just got hit by a massive storm. How's the weather where you are?
It's a little overcast. We get storms very commonly here. It's a tropical country, so there's at least one thunderstorm a week.
Yeah, as I was telling you off cast, we had a massive storm like a few days ago. I think literally like 3 days ago, we just had a huge storm, and now we have another one here. So it's definitely the rainy season here as well, and hopefully this will be it, but I know we still have one more month of summer left.
Yes.
Again, Charles, it was a pleasure finally getting a chance to talk to you. I know you sent me an email, I think it was like about a few weeks ago, and we've been trying to get timing around. Like we just said, I think there's about a 12-hour difference between the two of us, and it's always interesting to have these international conversations through Skype and Game Wisdom.
Yes, and I've learned from experience to always quote time zones when talking to people as well now.
Yeah. For those of you who don't do like podcasting or like long distance discussions, you have to do that whenever you start doing this, or the whole timing thing just gets thrown out of whack.
Yeah.
So to get started then, Charles, since this is your first time on the cast, could you tell everyone listening a little bit about yourself and sort of your background when it comes to game development?
Sure. Okay. My background is as a friend of mine once said, all programmers really want to write computer games, and some of them just take a long time to get around to it. And for me, I worked in IT for about 15 years, and then I had the opportunity to come out here to Kuala Lumpur and not have a job. So I had to think about what I wanted to do, and it seemed to me that writing a computer game would be the best idea. Well, the best idea I had. So that's what I did. So it's been 4 years now. 4 years in Malaysia, and 4 years writing Concealed Intent. And I'm almost at the point of releasing it. 1 week, I think. 1 week today. 1 week today. Yes, yeah. I'm going to put it out on Steam as a full release rather. And although that probably won't be the end, there'll probably be a 1.1 release after that in a few months.
Cool. I'm sorry, Charles, as you just about to say you're putting the game out, the Skype call is sort of like, I lost you. I think it may be the connection between us right now.
Yes, well, yeah, that does happen a bit.
Yeah. with, That's
especially
all right.
With calls here. Mm-hmm. I just said I'm putting it out next week, and it's been a long process, and it probably won't be the end of it.
Awesome. Now, I know by the time this cast goes up, I think it will probably be out by the time this cast goes up. So here's a early congratulations for you, Charles, which will be relevant for the people listening to this cast.
Thank you.
So you've been working on Concealed Intent for, I think you said, 4 years now?
4 years. 4 years was when I sat down to start brainstorming ideas.
Man, so 4 years, that would be about 2012, so like right around the time of sort of like the boom of crowdfunding and Kickstarter and all that.
Yes, it was.
Did you do any like crowdfunding for Concealed Intent at that time?
I did not. I had to think about it. I think I even wrote something online. I wouldn't know where it was anymore. Mm-hmm. About why I wasn't going to do it, which is basically that I didn't feel I had enough of a background in games. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any networks or community around it. I didn't think that I could get enough people interested in a short enough period of time. I'm not a natural marketing person. I find it quite hard.
Yeah.
To do these things. So I thought that, and being by myself, every day I spend or every hour I spend marketing is an hour I don't spend working on the game. So I didn't really feel that I could do that. But I remember that time quite well with all those Kickstarters. The Star Citizen and the Elite Kickstarter mm-hmm. started just after I started. I don't know if you remember in 2000. Right now, there's tons and tons of these space games around.
Yeah.
Anyway, similar theme to me. But I remember thinking in 2012, oh, there's none of these games. There's no space games. I should do a space game because I really enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
And, things changed so much in 4 years. I guess it's,
Yeah, and we were talking about this before the cast, but you went on Space Game Junkies podcast and spoke with Brian Rubin, who's also a fan and frequent guest of the site here. And he said pretty much the same thing. When he started the site, there were no space games, you know, they're super niche, there are very few. He thought this would be like an easy gig for him, and now the market is just flooded with him. He doesn't know what to do anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I was on a local Facebook group. A local indie dev was talking about what sort of games should he do now. And he said, for instance, that there's no, I can't remember what genre he said, but there were no games in this genre, so they should do that. And I suggested, well, you know, it's going to take you probably 2 to 3 years. Think about what genres will be popular in 2 to 3 years, if you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ben. For my, I guess for like my little tangent, the genre that I'm really missing right now is the city builder or city simulation genre, which there just aren't a lot of games for now. But then again, maybe in 2-3 years, I'll be overflowed with them as well.
Yes. Well, I think, a lot of people were a bit scared by SimCity. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of news about it coming out, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And then it didn't. So maybe there'll be a lot of people trying to do that now. Now that they've seen that didn't work out so well.
Yeah, and especially as we're seeing a lot, but you can attest to as well, Charles, the indie community has really picked up with a lot of these niche and not as, I guess, mass-marketed genres these days. Over this last year, of course, we saw the release of both Undertale and Stardew Valley, which both of those games didn't look like they would be like these massive things. And they both just really struck a chord with the community and just with the market itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the huge benefits of an indie scene is that you can try these things out, or that for a start, there's so many indies mm-hmm. that people will try interesting things to see how they work.
And it's just how we've seen so many unique games. And we were talking about this on a previous cast. I'm not sure it was the week before or a few weeks before when this one goes up, but sort of how the indie scene has really risen to become not just respected among its peers, but we're seeing the console market sort of take notice, and we're seeing more independent developers being approached for console ports, stuff like Shovel Knight or Claire Entertainment with Don't Starve.
Yes, you dropped out a bit there.
I'm sorry, I said that we've really seen the independent market not only be accepted by its peers, but the console market is now taking an interest with bringing over these games, such as Shovel Knight and Don't Starve from Clay Entertainment.
Yes. And I think a big part of that is the tools have risen to mm-hmm. such an incredible level in functionality and decreased in price that sort of thing becomes easier. I think many of the big toolkits, I know Unity does, mm-hmm. Can cross over to the PlayStation and the Xbox. So porting them across is a little bit easier as well, which also helps.
Yeah, and the digital market, I think, has also been a major factor. I know this is definitely a topic we've brought up on previous casts, but again, the ability for developers to release games without needing a publisher or needing a physical space has done wonders for the indie market.
Absolutely. Concealed Intent would not exist without digital distribution. It would never have happened.
definitely. And we could probably turn this into another Steamcast as well. But I think for those of you listening, I think we've explained the merits of Steam multiple times already. Now, going back to Concealer 10, as we said, you started working on this game in 2012. Where did the original concept, or what sort of led you to start working on the game in the first place?
Okay, well, the decision was first that I wanted to write a game.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided that the best way to do it was to come up with a list of ideas. So I came up with 10 ideas, and this is, in retrospect, it seems a bit silly. I picked the smallest one.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that's silly is because Concealed Intent is, I think, way too big. Or at least the original idea was bigger than has been developed. Mm-hmm. And I think what I developed was way too big for one person, thus taking four years. So I picked the smallest idea. And how it started was I was a big fan of Homeworld. I was a big fan of Frozen Synapse, which was mm-hmm. I was playing at the time. And I wanted to kind of merge them. I hadn't really seen something like Frozen Synapse in three dimensions. And at that time, Homeworld, there wasn't any talk of a reissue. It was 10 years in the past. So that was the two original things. And I thought, how to make it a little different? And I was thinking about the nature of space combat. Mm-hmm. And some games do it like big ships, big capital ships blasting each other. And some games do it like space fighter planes, where you're dodging and weaving. So I thought, how about I do it something like submarines as something different? So that's how the sort of detection and the stealth, and why things like the active sonars sound like a ping. The active sensors sound like mm-hmm. a sonar ping.
Yeah, but I know you just mentioned Frozen Synapse, and that was another big game for the simultaneous turn-based strategy genre at the time. And I think one thing, I mentioned this on the Spotlight video I put up for Concealed Intent, but we need to figure out a clever acronym or something for the simultaneous turn-based strategy genre. It's just such a mouthful to get out.
Yes, I've heard people call it WeGo.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's a sort of, I think that's a niche grouping in a niche area.
Yeah.
As you said, it is a small market, a small niche for these types of games, I think.
Yeah. But it is a market, but it's still a viable market, as we can see with Frozen Synapse. It just requires a very different take on design, and I'm sure you are no doubt aware of after working on the game for 4 years.
Yes, yes.
I guess sort of to lead into our discussion about Concealed Intent and the, well, for the rest of this cast, we'll call it the WeGo genre, just to make it easier on our tongues. With, I guess, the genre itself, for people listening to this cast who may have heard of it or may not play any games, how would you describe it to, like, a non-fan or to just, like, a listener to the cast?
Oh, okay. I think of it like a board game in that mm-hmm. you can, in turn-based games, each player does their actions, like in a board game, one person. But with the WeGo or the simultaneous turn-based, each player plans their actions simultaneously at the same time, and then they play out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you get when I play, you get the benefit of being able to do it at your own speed, but you still get that sense of uncertainty about what's going to happen. There's still a bit of, you're not sure exactly, you don't get that perfect information that you often do with board games or other turn-based games, and that you can see what the other person did and react to that. Instead, you're more forced to anticipate what the other player is going to do in their turn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what I said on my video Spotlight. It does feel very much like a board game compared to especially the real-time strategy genre. But it is different in the sense that both sides are basically relying not on perfect information. They basically each have a similar source, but it's not the same way as if I'm playing like a game like StarCraft, where I'm allowed to make, you know, instant adjustments in microseconds as to what you're doing. As you just said, it's more about sort of reading the other player and seeing, okay, I think he's going to do this, so let me do this instead to counter him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was the thing that I really enjoyed mm-hmm. about frozen synapse is that you have to, because when I started playing, you know, you'd run towards where the enemy are at that time, but you soon learn that you end up yeah. dead very quickly. You've got to think, you know, how are they going to move? If they move over here, then I need to do this. And it's not a case of just working out what is the best, what are they most likely to do and dealing with that. You also think, what if they do something different? If I do what I think is best, that may put me in for a very bad position if they do something slightly different. So you have to sort of balance those.
It's sort of like I need to think that he knows what I know, what I think he knows, what I know kind of thing.
Exactly. Brian from Space Game Junkie had, I think, a great comment that these games greatly reward careful planning.
Yes, definitely. Especially with Frozen Synapse itself. I played that game a few years ago, and as you just said, Charles, it is a game that if you make one plan, if you don't basically make a plan B during your first plan, it's very easy to get punished. And it's one of those games that you do have to spend a long time trying to calculate every little move, every little action per turn, which on one hand is what makes the genre so niche, but the other, it's what has really given its own sense of a community and market.
It's the sort of game I like. I tend to play the more strategy or slower-paced games. Mm-hmm. I don't have the reactions for the quick games, so that sort of thing is the thing that I like.
Yeah, but I've long since given up trying to do like professional real-time strategy play. I just don't have the dexterity for that kind of play anymore.
Yes.
Now, with Conceal a Tent and the WeGo game design in general, has the game, I guess, changed in terms of its design since you first started it, like in any like terms of systems or mechanics?
It has changed massively. Mm-hmm. There are certain things that I wanted not to change. Mm-hmm. And that it was simultaneous turn-based, that it was 3D in space, and that it had this kind of detection stealth system. Mm-hmm. There were sort of three things, like the bit I took from Frozen Synapse, the bit I took from Homeworld, and the bit I took from Submarine Games.
Yeah.
But beyond that, pretty much everything has changed. The original version, I had a version I sent out to playtesters after about a year, and it basically came back that they considered it unplayable because it was far more complex. It had a more realistic physics-based model in there with mm-hmm. the speed of light, and there are still bits of it in there if you look carefully. But for instance, if something was 150,000 kilometers away, it would take half a second for your laser to reach it. If you were sharing detection among your drones, how far away you were would make a big difference to how well the detection was, because they'd have to communicate at the speed of light between each other. Mm-hmm. And that really confused people. You know, why isn't my lasers instant? Why aren't they just instantly reaching the enemy? And on top of that was built a far more complex control system. It was actually something I remember you mentioned in your video, mm-hmm. you were talking about how Frozen Synapse, it's more like if this happens and do this, and you sort of stack actions on top of each other.
Yeah,
that used to be in Concealed Intent as well. Mm-hmm. But that also used to greatly confuse people. You know, they just wanted to know, what is my chance to hit? So previously you didn't have your chance to hit, that percentage that appears mm-hmm. When you hover over an enemy. You just said, I'm willing to, if it's very likely to hit, or if I'm certain to hit, or if it's possible I'll hit. You had those sort of bands instead, mm-hmm. and then the game would calculate what the appropriate percentage was to start shooting. People really didn't like that, and I think that was actually a very fair criticism. I think it's on another podcast I heard people say that the game shouldn't be having more fun than the player. That might have been a case of the game having more fun than the player, or at least the program of the game having more fun than the player. And so it's been simplified a lot over that time. Yeah, there was also original grand plans for a slightly more open world or a stronger story. The story is being continually de-emphasized now, so mm-hmm. It's quite it's quite a surfacey story, because that was also a matter of just, I think, too big a job.
Yeah. And a lot of great things to unpack what you're just talking about, Charles, regarding sort of the evolution of the game, especially for a WeGo game where the mechanics really are going to be the heart and soul of the game. If something doesn't feel like it's working, it's just going to infer on every aspect of playing the game.
Yes, yes. But although, having said that, there are some things that that people didn't like, mm-hmm. but that I refused to change. And yeah. that's largely the detection and the stealth system.
Mm-hmm. And that's always one of the very challenging things about game development. One of the more interesting topics to talk about in these casts is that balance between how malleable am I going to be? And this has become even more important with developers who go the early access or Steam Greenlight concept, which I know you, Concealed Tech, was on early access. So you got the additional benefit of the Steam audience looking at the game, talking about it, saying, you know, what we like, what we don't. And
yep.
that is a very tricky thing to balance, especially for any game developer, you know, worth their salt. You know, how am I, if they like this or if they don't like this, do I change it? Do I, you know, leave it alone? Do I go with my gut? I mean, these are questions that anyone has been working in games has had to think about, but now it's all the more prevalent when you're actually talking to the people who have already bought your game and giving you their feedback.
Yeah, I think that's one of the benefits of early access. Mm-hmm. I think that it's worked very well for Concealed Intent. But by the time I got onto early access, which was 8 months ago, mm-hmm. When I say that there was a core things that I didn't want to change and everything else did, that wasn't what I thought when I started. Mm-hmm. That sort of evolved over the 3 months up to the point I got to early access. Like I found myself willing to compromise or willing to change some aspects, but some bits I didn't want to because I felt that it wouldn't be Concealed Intent if I made those changes. If I made it 2D, it mm-hmm. wouldn't be Concealed Intent. If I took out the possibility of ships disappearing, it wouldn't be Concealed Intent. Mm-hmm. So that was just never going to happen.
Yeah.
So by the time I reached early access, I had a much better conception of what the game was. And I actually went into Concealed Intent with a particular question in mind, what I wanted from doing it. And I got it answered after a couple of months, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say what the question was. It was, I've done a sort of scattershot. There's a single player campaign. There's skirmish options, procedural skirmish options, and online play. And I discovered as a solo developer, it would be incredibly difficult to build all of those out. I think they're all at a good level, mm-hmm. but you know, each of them could be extended forever. So the question I really wanted to know was what of those is most important to people?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer most people came back with was the procedural skirmish. So that's where most of my time has been spent on.
Yeah, and that is a good point and a good use of early access. Over the last year or so, I've spoken to a lot of developers, and I've heard a vast range of opinions on the early access. A lot of developers do like the system for reasons that we've talked about, and then there are those who prefer to just work on the game, like sort of in solitude, but not so much in solitude, but more along the lines of they want to make sure this game is as perfect as can be before, you know, outside eyes are on it. And there's always that push and pull as a game developer, especially when we talk about that balance between being an art and a product. You want the game to be the best it can be when people first see it, but at the same time, you want to make something that you know is going to be marketed well, that you know that you can sell it very easily to people when it gets put on Steam.
Yes, that's very true. And it's also, I think it's also very common that a developer, the ideas that a developer has, or certainly that I had, mm-hmm. may not necessarily make for a very good game.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I think my original ideas, now when I look back at them, I think that they were naive and hopelessly complex. I think the game is better as a result of those changes I made.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't have made them if I didn't show them to people.
Yeah.
And my natural reaction is to not show it to people.
Mm-hmm.
I could very easily have just gone on for years more, you know, making incredible online multiplayer, making incredible branching campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you have to finish. You have to.
Yes.
You have to get it done.
Yeah, of course. You have to finish the game and hopefully, you know, get the money you need so you can stay in business.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's, I know we're laughing about it, but a lot of developers, especially first-time developers or first-time people in the indie scene, can often struggle with that. They can spend, you know, years working on a game, again, in complete isolation. They're going to just say, I'm going, as you said with Concealed 10, I'm going to make my campaign, you know, completely procedurally generated. It'll be, you know, hundreds of hours of replayability. And I'm going to do the online multiplayer on top of that. And they'll just keep working on the game. And again, they're just going to keep doing this way past the point of no return. And too often, some of these games can fall into, you know, the everything in the kitchen sink kind of design, where it doesn't feel like a single concentrated thought, but like a number of things stitched together.
Yeah, yes.
And it's a topic that we've been talking a lot about on Game Wisdom, with sort of this concept of harmonizing game design, where everything fits together when you know what your core gameplay mechanic is going to be, and then everything is built around that. And what you were saying about Concealed 10 a few minutes ago, with the elements that you refuse to change, those would pretty much be like that main gameplay mechanic. And again, if you were to change that, you wouldn't have Concealed Intent.
Yes, there are many turn-based 2D games where you shoot at other ships.
Mm-hmm.
And Concealed Intent wouldn't stand out or be notable in any way if yeah. I changed those things.
Exactly. And going back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, it's one of those things that we're seeing a lot of independent developers are kind of in a sink or swim kind of situation with having to stand out in this market. As we talked about, the barrier of entry has gone way down over the last 5-6 years, thanks to Steam, digital distribution, and game engine tools. And you really need to do everything you can to make your game, you know, stand more prominently compared to everything else.
Very much so. Although, yes, I say as a counterpoint to that, if you are, I think as, again, you said in your video quite correctly that you know, Concealed Intent is a niche game in a niche mm-hmm. a niche field. So it can be very hard to stand out, especially when you go to something which is quite a bit more. Well, I don't know if I'd describe my game as incredibly different, but it is slightly different from mm-hmm. Other games. And that can make it a bit harder to explain what it is and why people might like it, and find the people who might like it compared to the vast majority of people who probably wouldn't.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of interesting about sort of the greater strategy genre as a whole, is that we're seeing it sort of have that resurgence among the independent scene. Like Paradox Interactive has really become one of the more, I wouldn't say mainstream, but they become a lot more well-known over the last 5-6 years, thanks to getting on Steam. And of course, there's always the Civilization series, which has still kind of holds the banner for the strategy genre in terms of the mainstream consumer market.
Yes, but those things have been built up over a long time,
yeah.
Haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also, I think Paradox is, I love Crusader Kings 2. I think that's
mm-hmm.
after Concealed Intent, that's probably the.
Charles, you kind of cut out as soon as you said Paradox Software. You're still there.
Oh, yeah. I was saying that I was talking about how much I enjoyed Crusader Kings 2,
mm-hmm.
and I think they do very good fan service
mm-hmm.
in that they keep looking after their games and making them better over time. Although some might say that perhaps they should be better at the start sometimes.
Yeah.
But they get there in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I'm someone who doesn't buy games when they first come out. I haven't got Stellaris yet, but maybe in a year's time, or almost certainly in a year's time, I'll probably have it.
Yeah, but probably by then they'll release like a Game of the Year pack or a DLC collection and stuff like that.
Yes.
Now, going back to Concealed Intent, and I guess sort of framing this with the WeGo genre itself, as someone who spent the last 3 years working on a WeGo game, as you said, changing the design, examining it, etc., I guess in your opinion, Charles, what do you think are like the best qualities of the WeGo genre, the things that people should be looking for, and what are some of the things, like if you ran into any like red flags or design issues that you were having with the overall game development?
Okay. I think, yeah, with Concealed Intent, it was the feeling of anticipation and planning that I was really after. It was why I went with the WeGo mechanic, and that you could still have that sort of planning and thinking ahead, but at the same time having time to plan things out. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I think it works very well online in that you don't have to wait for people. If you're going to play online, you send your turn in, the other person sends a turn, and you're not sitting and doing nothing and waiting. I suppose that's a good way of putting it. There's still a bit of push forward in the game when you're playing, because you're never sitting and waiting for the other player. Mm-hmm. You're always either thinking about what you should be doing or seeing the results of what you've done. You're not sitting and watching a little spinning timer saying the other person is thinking about their move, or if you're online or playing against someone else in person, you're not just sort of sitting there looking at them as they do it. You're always doing something about with the game. So I think that is the main benefits to me of the WeGo genre, forcing the player to anticipate, keeping them doing things, although that's less of an issue on a computer, mm-hmm. because hopefully the computer's quite fast. And as for problems with it, I guess the two things are, on a computer at least, I found it a little, you have to think carefully about how you're going to handle your internal model, mm-hmm. and how you're going to essentially hide the information of what's going on between two players until the point you play. And that's would be even worse in a tabletop game, which is why it's very rarely done in tabletop games, is you have to somehow hide your commands. You have to have a little barrier to keep the commands behind, mm-hmm. or turn them over. It's thinking something like the Game of Thrones board game, where you have your commands turned over, mm-hmm. Hidden, and then you flip them over and everyone can see what you were doing. But in the computer game, you have to think about the internal model. And once again, going back to Frozen Synapse with their rewind and move forward, mm-hmm. very well. You have to sort of keep it separately, I found. Yeah. And the other one being that you have to make sure your AI is fast enough and simple enough that still gives the impression of being intelligent, mm-hmm. that the other player is not left waiting.
Yeah. And what you were just saying regarding the information to show the player, I think that's another really good point. I know you talked about this earlier with the decision behind the two-hit chance and whether to show it or to just use a generalized description for it. And that, I think, is another very tricky part, not just in the WeGo genre, but in the strategy genre in general. One of the posts I think I made probably a few months by the time this cast is up, was talking about that. If you give the player too much information, then the game is just basically playing itself. You said a few minutes ago that you don't want a game where it seems the AI is having more fun than the player. But on the other hand, if you give them too little information, then the player has no idea what they're doing, and in response, they won't know essentially how the game is being played or how what they're doing is impacting the game. Then they're just going to get lost. And we see that with a lot of either high-level thinking strategy games or with a lot of indie games where the developers, again, have trouble just properly conveying everything to their player. So only like the hardcore niche fans will figure it out.
Yes, yes. I mean, I hadn't... I hadn't thought about that as a particular... Do you think that's a particular property of the Wego genre?
I think that is more of just like the strategy genre in general. So we're talking about, you know, the turn-based, 4X, and even we could also say in some sense the real-time strategy. But real-time strategy also has the extra wrinkle of the fact that there is a lot of player physicality or hand-eye coordination that goes along with it. You may know exactly what's going on, but you may not have the finger speed or the hockey memorization to get it done to your liking.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, because I had a great deal of difficulty explaining to players through the game, not me explaining to them in person, but explaining through the game how the detection system works. Because it's a little different and not used, not something that is copied from somewhere else that people are familiar with. Trying to explain how it worked and how the detection was gained or lost and the possibility of disappearing, that was very hard for me to do. And I'm still not entirely certain that I've explained it particularly well, because you don't want to end up with these massive tutorials at the start because people just don't play them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. The other thing that you said that resonates, which is a problem of the, I think, the Wego genre, is especially in my games, how things change while the game is playing out, and then they all play out at the same time. So how the controls influence how the game is played out, and how the game is played out influences the state of the game when... That's also something you really have to think about. So for there, as I said, in the original version, it was more like frozen synapse, and that you could stack actions, you know, and then move here, wait, then move there. And I took all that, I took that out to make it simpler, especially in a 3D space. The GUI was a bit unwieldy.
Yeah, and that was, not to interrupt you, I just want to comment, that was one of the things that kind of, as someone who's not a fan of the Wego genre, that was one of the things that did annoy me about Frozen Synapse. And again, how... Again, I don't want to use the term, like, fiddly, because I don't think it really it applies here, but just how, I guess, micro-intensive, in a sense, your actual turn planning and the controls were in the game.
Yes, no, I think that's a good point. They are quite complicated. And, I never really thought about it till I tried to implement it myself, and I simplified it. I simplified it, so it's not quite as complex as Frozen Synapse. But I still watching people play on videos online. I still see there are issues there.
Yeah, and I think you made another good point about tutorial design. Tutorial design, in my opinion, like up there with controls and UI as a very underrated and sometimes underappreciated part of developing a game. Because talking about the strategy genre as a whole, strategy games typically feature some of like the worst tutorials that I've seen. They either give you too little information, you're like, what the hell am I doing? Or, as you just said, you have like an hour and a half tutorial that you're going to fall asleep by like 3 minutes in.
Yes, and again, that's something that I've greatly struggled with. And I think it's largely a nature of these games that under the hood, they are actually, the simulation can be quite complex.
Yes.
And yeah, I think the tutorial I've got is, I think, it's constantly evolved, but it's, I think, the right of the tutorial. I mean, I had a separate tutorial which was just running through the basic instructions, which was there at start, and then...
Charles, you kind of cut out again. Oh. You were saying the word start, and then you cut out.
I don't remember saying start.
Oh, then you said you were saying something that just cut out.
I was talking about how the tutorial I tried for the tutorial for Concealed Intent is being completely rewritten.
Yeah.
Rewritten at least three times. So at least four versions of it, and then constantly evolve, and that it went from being essentially a list of commands to being trying to integrate it with the campaign, but that actually worked worse. So then it went back to being half outside and then half in the campaign. And now I've got to a sort of, most of the instructions are at the start, and then the first two missions of the campaign give you a few hints as well for people who didn't do the tutorial. But yeah, no, it is immensely hard. And I think that's because of the complexity of the underlying simulations. Yeah. I have a lot more respect for good tutorials now than I did 4 years ago.
Yes. And I think you made a good point about trying to explain the abstraction. I think that's another very tricky part, not just of the WeGo genre, but in any kind of game design, especially in the strategy genre. There's a lot that goes under the hood that you never want the player to see. It's why a lot of games, especially in the RPG genre, tend to abstract numbers and values. So instead of seeing, you know, complex figures that tell you whether you're going to hit or not, you basically have something like, your character's dexterity is 10, means he has this amount of chance to hit. And you basically have to create a system on top of the system that you can actually show the player so they can kind of understand what's going on.
Yes, and also, you dropped out a bit there, so I'm going to talk based on what I think you said. And also, you need to cut down your simulation model.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can't, if you throw it, you end up with...
I'm sorry, you cut it out as well. As soon as you said your abstraction model, I lost you.
Oh, yeah. You have to basically cut parts of it out,
mm-hmm.
to show to the player and then add them back in again slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And that can also be a bit hard.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you put everything in at once, people just get completely lost at the beginning, like I think a lot of people did with Crusader Kings 2, which comes to mind because I was a bit lost at the start of that, and I played those games.
Yeah, me too. One of these days, maybe I'll learn how to play a game from Paradox Interactive. Someday, I don't know when. But I think another part of this challenge, and this I think goes back to another post I wrote, is the fact that these games are constantly evolving through their design. As you said, you've made numerous revisions and changes to the game over the 4 years of development. So any kind of tutorial you would have made would have been, you know, out of date the very next patch. And it's why a lot of developers or a lot of game designers normally wait until like the very end to make their tutorial. But then, of course, they're saving something so crucial as, you know, like the finishing up or the last touches on their game.
Yes, yes. And I think it would be hard to leave the tutorial to the end. I mean, how would you get wouldn't get very good readings from your playtesters, mm-hmm. if you didn't have something? Yeah. No, it's an interesting question.
Yeah. I made a post about this a few months ago, but in my opinion, whenever I'm like learning a tutorial or trying to understand a game, there's basically three questions that I like to see answered by the developer when it comes to their mechanics. The first one is, what am I doing? How do I do this? And then why am I doing this? And it's that last one, the why, that I think a lot of game designers struggle with. Because again, it feeds back into that balance between too little and too much information. Telling the player, oh, you need to, let's say, harvest a forest for lumber. If you tell the player, like, oh, you need to do this every time, you know, this happens, and you're basically playing the game for them. So how do you tell the player why they need to do something without telling them when to do it? And it's one of those things that I don't think there's an easy answer for.
Yes. No, I agree with you there. Tutorials require a lot of work, and it's probably something that I at least greatly underestimated when I started.
Yeah. Now, another part of Concealed 10 I do want to touch on, even if it's just like for a few minutes, is the UI. The UI of a strategy game is, of course, another very important and often overlooked element when it comes to designing them. With Concealed Attent, how did you approach like the UI design? I know from playing the game and doing my video spotlight, you have both the, I guess, the visual UI with along the bottom of the screen, and then you have like the sort of like the hotkey, or I'm not even sure how you would call it, the UI that sort of pops up if you right-click on a ship.
Yes, the UI that pops up when you right-click on the ship, mm-hmm. that was the original UI.
Okay.
That was what was there before, and there was less information
mm-hmm.
on the rest of the screen. So all the command, it was much more, again, like Frozen Synapse,
mm-hmm.
where when you click on one of your men in Frozen Synapse, the controls appear around them.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly how it was in the early stage, or even into quite late stages, actually, of Concealed Intent.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found was when people were, when I was playing it or when other people were playing it, I just watched them and they'd be click, 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 click. There was just, it was too much clicking to get something happening on the screen. Mm-hmm. So I just continually went further and further, adding in extra controls. So the right click to select a move point, or left click to select a ship, right click to move to a particular point in space, or right click on another ship to either move to it or shoot it, mm-hmm. Or plan to move or shoot. And so that just evolved, and it reached a point where I noticed that you didn't need those controls anymore. They weren't really adding anything. They were appearing on the screen. There was lots of code being added to make sure they didn't overlap, mm-hmm. with other ships' hubs. So they were moving around the screen as you rotated. That's something that I've learned, is that if you make a 3D game where in Concealed Intent the camera has 5 degrees of freedom, mm-hmm. at the player's fingertips, that makes your GUI, an in-game GUI, super hard. And so you want to have the most lightweight GUI you can. Mm-hmm. And so once I kept adding in these shortcuts, eventually I realized I didn't need those buttons anymore, and it was just time to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. So that's when they were hidden. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed I and a lot of other people, when I see videos, never really right-click to get those buttons up. But I left them there, mm-hmm. so people could hopefully make the connection between what their ship, the components that a ship has loaded, and the actions that they can do. Mm-hmm. Because many people didn't. There's an explicit one-to-one connection between what your ship has on it, mm-hmm. and what you're able to do in a turn.
Yeah.
But many people never made that. Many of the playtesters never made that connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's kind of tricky when you have a UI that kind of pops in and out like that. Because I think for a lot of people, I know for myself, I like to have that information basically always up. I like to basically have something that I can reference at a moment's notice. So whenever something is hidden, it's oftentimes forgotten. Or worse, the player forgets where it was actually located, and then they have to sort of dig through the UI. It's one of the reasons why a lot of these strategy games are so difficult to learn when you have layers of screens or layers of UI in order to find, let's say, the answer to why my research isn't working or what's my income coming in, those kinds of things.
Yes, and the earlier versions of Concealed Intent actually had subscreens as well. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Yeah. So if you look at, I think now I would hope that most of the information, in fact, all of the information on a ship is available on the stats panel in the center bottom. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can either look at that or hover over a component, and it should show you all the statistics that feed into the simulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So without needing to click, other than selecting the ship. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sorry, go on.
Oh, I was just about to say, regarding like a UI, like sort of like having those layers of information, it reminds me of a lot of, again, I go back to that example, but Age of Empires 3 by Ensemble Studios from, wow, I don't even remember what year. I know it was early thousands. It's just been so long. And what they did was they had like different amounts of information that could be shown to the player. So you had like the very generalized one that just says, you know, click attack, or character has 15 points of attack. And then for players who want to dig into it, they had like the advanced numbers and rules about how things worked. But the beauty of the system was that to learn the game, you just needed that surface layer. You didn't need to dig in to figure out how things work. The UI was clean enough and informative enough to show you on first glance.
Oh, yeah. And how did you swap between them? Was there some...
With Age of Empires 3, I think it was either an option on the UI or an option in the actual like game options menu that you sort of could choose between normal, advanced, or expert, or something along those lines of how detailed you wanted the UI to tell you. Like at the highest detail, would literally say something like, this research will increase your attack by 5.0, it will increase production time by 3.2%, and like it just went, you know, pretty much completely low level to the player. And again, for like the casual person, they would they won't even know where to begin with that. But for expert players, it was kind of handy for them to know these kind of hard numbers and values.
I'm sorry, you dropped out for most of that.
What I said was, Ensemble basically either had it as an option on the UI or in the game options itself. So you could choose between either normal information, a little more detailed information, or all the information. Mm. And at like the highest detail, it basically broke things down by like a low level kind of formula. So it said like this research would give you 5.3 points of offense, increase research by 2.6. It basically gave you, you know, more information you would ever need to know if you just wanted to play the game.
I'd be very interested to know how many people changed the default setting for that.
Yeah, that would be a really good stat. Because again, for the casual player, your general audience, they would probably never click that button. But for people wanting to know more, or the experts who are, again, like for like competitive level games or competitive level gameplay, that information will probably be invaluable for them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the kind of person who, when they play a strategy game, just clicks on all the buttons just to see what they do. But another thing I've noticed is that most people don't do that. Most people just stick with what the default is.
Yeah, and that I think is a really good point there too, Charles, regarding sort of like the default scheme or the basic configuration of UI. It's so important to get your basic layout to be as best as it can be, because you can't assume that your audience is going to dig into things to change it or move things around. And that's another thing that I see a lot of game developers who tend to struggle with. They just leave the UI saying, oh, we'll just let the player, you know, put all the hotkeys in, or, you know, move the elements exactly how they want. So they just leave it all being very cluttered or all over the place.
That's, I think that makes a big difference to a game. I know I actually hired a local graphic designer for about 100 hours to work on various ideas for the GUI and various or creating the 2D graphics for it, and that made a huge difference. Being able to talk to someone who doesn't play strategy games, and knows about design more than me, just so how they sort of laid things out and everything, and it's pretty close to what they came up with. They really liked asymmetry, and I don't, so I changed it to make everything symmetrical. It can help to get either a second opinion or a professional opinion on the layout, because it does make a big difference how default appears on the screen.
Definitely, and that's another benefit of early access, with being able to show your game to essentially your consumer base. If anyone's going to say whether or not the game is easy to learn or it's not working right, chances are it's going to be them. And it's that classic trap of essentially you're just too far into the game that's hard for the designer to essentially see what your game is like from the perspective of someone brand new.
Yes.
Yeah, and a lot of great discussions we've had so far, Charles, especially regarding sort of the design, especially the changing scope of development. And one part that I want to touch on that you brought up before the cast was developing the online side of things. Earlier in the cast, you mentioned how the game was really split between essentially three different modes. You had the single-player campaign, you had the procedurally generated skirmish mode, and then you had the online sort of competitive play between real players. And you said that you had to make a decision between just what exactly you wanted to support and develop. And before the cast, you mentioned that part of the challenge of Concealed Tent was the online community side of it. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that for the people listening.
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. So the problem I found with the online side is the game was originally conceived to have a component. And the problem with that is if you're going to do an online game, firstly, it requires quite a bit of extra coding.
Yes.
But more importantly, it requires a huge amount of extra effort in building a community online around the game, so there are people to play online. you can't just put a game out and say, here it is, play online.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there isn't if someone can't open up the game and start playing with someone online, then that's going to be a very bad online experience.
Mm-hmm.
So as a small indie game, that's something I've massively struggled with, getting enough people online to play. And in fact, I would say I've completely failed in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
If you go on and hit random duel, chances are more likely than not, there will be no one else online at the time. So what I did to try and overcome that was add the ability to challenge a friend asynchronously. So if someone else in your Steam friends list
mm-hmm.
has the game, you can challenge them and you can play at separate times, essentially sort of play by email. Just log on, see what they've done, put in your own plans, go away, come back a day or two later, or whatever time frame you've set between each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was when I went into early access, having these three foci of the game wasn't really tenable to build them out to the level that I wanted. So I had to really look at one. And so I asked people, what is most important? And mm-hmm. it came back that the skirmish was most important. So
mm-hmm. yeah. And I think...
Is that...
I'm sorry?
Sorry, go on.
I was about to talk more about the online community side of things. Did you have anything to finish up?
No, go ahead.
Okay. What I was about to say is, I think it's very interesting, again, about sort of deciding what area to focus on, conceal the tent. And multiplayer is one of those things that it's actually part of a post I made a few months ago where I basically said, like, three elements where the fans have it wrong. And one of those is the common cry of, just add multiplayer to your game. You know, it's so easy. You know, it will make your game sell much more. Just add an online component. And it really is a lot more work. And not only a lot more work, but as you said, a lot more resource intensive. And even then, it can be somewhat of a gamble to put into your game. Because as you just said, if you try and launch a game with an online component without having a community, it's just not going to work. And the thing about online games is it has to be ready from day one, minute one of your game being out. If your online community doesn't develop for, let's say, 2 to 3 months after its launch, chances are it's going to never develop.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think players of games say just add online, firstly, because they don't realize mm-hmm. how hard it is. But second is they think of these massively successful
mm-hmm.
Online games, and you look at the most successful games, most of them are online.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're massively successful online because they're big.
Mm-hmm.
And as an indie, it's really a sort of chicken and the egg problem, which comes first. And often I think the response will be neither.
Mm-hmm.
You'll never get big enough to be a big online game.
Mm-hmm.
Or very rarely is the case.
Yeah, but unless your game is basically developed from minute one as an online experience, it's just not feasible. And that's another area where a first-time developer can screw up with. You can't just wait until 75% of your game is done to say, oh, let's just throw in a multiplayer side to it. It will be great. And as you just said, the fans like, yeah, the best games have it, so why not? If your game isn't integrated with online play, again, from the very beginning, it just becomes almost impossible to get not only to work properly, but to establish that community and the resources needed by the time the game is done.
Yeah, I say that's largely right. Mm-hmm. I would say to adjust it slightly,
mm-hmm.
you have to think about online from the start. You may not need to have it integrated mm-hmm. from the start. You have to at least be aware of
yeah.
what effect online is going to have from the start.
Yeah. And there are cases where we've seen a lot, especially in the AAA market, where the multiplayer side is basically outsourced to another developer. And then you essentially have these two halves of a game being stitched together at the end. And a recent example that I think a lot of people may agree with is Doom 2016, and how a lot of people have praised the single-player side of things, but didn't necessarily like the multiplayer side. And as we were talking about a few seconds ago, multiplayer is just very big business these days. It's a common feature we see in just about any AAA game, because again, it's just a huge moneymaker, and it's one that can be continually supported, and it's why a lot of publishers tend to want that in there, no matter, you know, what the design of the single-player game may be.
Yes. Oh, I think, well, successful multiplayer adds a huge amount to a game. There was actually, have you, I saw a talk by, did you have a game called Flock?
Flock? No, I don't think I have.
They did a talk a while ago on their game, which is online only, and they basically say sort of similar things as an indie. They, you know, they had a great game, good online technology, but then they struggled with building the community. Just remembered that.
Yep, and a lot of this I think also goes back to the marketing side of games, and it's another area where we see a lot of first-time and independent developers tend to struggle with is, again, trying to build a community while you're building your game. As you said, I think, at the start of this cast, for every hour that you're busy doing PR, you're busy trying to reach out to people, is an hour that you've lost actually making this game. And for a lot of developers, it's they just cannot get both done. And for some of them, it's just not realistically possible, especially for like very small studios, like a 1-3 man group of people.
Absolutely. That was, I knew going in that marketing the game, because it was always intended to sell it. So I knew going in that I'd have to do a lot of marketing.
I'm sorry, Charles, you cut out after your always intended, the second one. You cut out there. I didn't hear that.
Well, I always intended to, so I knew, I was aware that marketing was required, but I was still, I started doing marketing. I did a burst for Greenlight, and I did another burst for Early Access when I went into Early Access. And what I realized with those is at both times, I was trying to code and market at the same time, and I just, I couldn't do it. I needed to make the decision what was more important. So for most of Early Access, I've been silent. You, no one, it's probably very few people have heard of my game, and that's largely because I just gave up on marketing. And so what I've done now is, it was 23 days ago, I finished adding features and said, I think this game is now good enough to go. And then from then to release in a week's time, I just wrote out a list of all the marketing things, all the marketing tasks I need to do. And that's what I do first every day. Every morning, what's on the list, do that. You know, and then if there's time after that, I'll work on the coding. You really have to, you have to decide what is most important. Can't do both. And I think that is a great problem. I found that the most common reaction people have when I get in contact with them is, oh, I've never heard of that before. So if you can, I think this is, to any of the indies out there, if you can, be in a team of more than one person and have at least one person whose job it is to, you know, build community and get the word out about your game. Because it is, obscurity is the biggest problem that that you'll have as an indie.
Yes, and that is, that should be, you know, put in lights and, you know, shine in the sky for independent developers. And I've spoken to a few developers, and I've seen them talk about this and how they spend, you know, 3-4 years working on a game. They don't do any PR, and they just really have struggled with getting the name and getting the game out there come release date. And I think and as you said, you started working on Concealed 10 in 2012, the market has just really changed over those last 4 years. And it's just becoming more and more important to have someone able to do that PR work. Unless you get really lucky and your game blows up like Undertale or Stardew Valley. But it's one of those things you can't bet your game or your studio on, because you just don't know if your game will be that quote-unquote, you know, the it game of the time.
Yes, I don't think there's a formula for it, or if there is, it wouldn't last for very long.
Yeah. All right. I am just about out of questions, so I think we'll move on to our final part for this cast. Are there any aspects of either Conceal a Tent or the time you spend working on the game that we haven't brought up yet that you'd like to talk about now?
And this is where my lack of marketing skills display themselves. I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Okay. I did just remember one thing I forgot to ask you earlier that I do want to bring up for this cast. As we said, you've been living in Malaysia for the last 4 years working on Conceal a Tent. And one of the questions I like to ask all my international guests is, how is like the scape of the, or how is like the environment of the game industry in Malaysia right now? Are there other like studios? Like, what's kind of going on there?
That's an interesting question, because I think it's changed a bit, at least mm-hmm. in the indie scene over the 4 years I've been here. Mm-hmm. And on the larger AAA scene, not much I think has changed. There's Codemasters has a studio here, mm-hmm. and there's a bunch of outsourced studios. And I know when Street Fighter V came out, the social media exploded because a lot of that was done here, apparently. Mm-hmm. But on the larger side, I think a lot is taken by Singapore, which is so close by and much larger in the game industry. Mm-hmm. On the indie side, though, things have massively grown. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Massive going in the last 4 years. And when I got here, I went to the GGJ, the Global Game Jam, mm-hmm. and there was one site in the country and there were five teams. And then I went this year, so four GGJs later, there were, I think, two or three sites. And at the site I was at, there were 31 teams. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's massively exploded the number of local game devs around. And I think there's been a few reasons for that. The IGDA has become much more active in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's to a large extent because, when was it? I think it was 2-3 years ago, the government came out with an economic plan to become I don't know what they call it, like a fully developed country, because Malaysia's sort of just on the cusp of that, mm-hmm. or maybe just under that sort of official status. And as part of that, they actually decided to promote the games industry, mainly the mobile games industry. So most people focus on mobile games, especially into the Asian market. But as part of that, they gave out, they run various programs to sort of give scholarships to young developers. Mm-hmm. I think it started out at 50,000 ringgit. I think it's now 100,000 ringgit. That would be 100,000 ringgit is about 25,000 US dollars. And you could certainly have a couple of young people could live on that without too much difficulty in Kuala Lumpur.
Yeah.
It's not quite ramen money. It's a bit better than that. So a number of people, I actually looked at applying for it, but I'm not Malaysian, I'm not allowed to join in, because there's a few people who are a team I was going to look at it with, but they had to drop me because I'm not Malaysian. Mm-hmm. But I know quite a few other people do that, including a very active member of the local IGDA. Mm-hmm. And so I think that money gave him the time to sort of promote the IGDA. So now there's monthly indie game dev meetings. Every Ludum Dare, mm-hmm. there'll be people doing it. There's bigger and better GGJs every year. And that's brought in other people like, have you heard of Game Founders?
It's a mobile familiar, thing. Yeah.
It's like a mobile incubator, mm-hmm. a mobile game incubator. So you apply to them, they put you up, give you advice and access to playtesters and experts, and in return they take a small percentage of your game. Mm-hmm. And they've started up here in as Kuala Lumpur as their Southeast Asian center. Mm-hmm. So as a result, there's been it's all largely mobile. There's been a huge amount of increase in the amount of indie dev happening, well, that I've noticed anyway. It's certainly a lot more visible.
Yeah.
I think I'm trying to think of local games. There's Velocibox mm-hmm. and Tiny Guardians. They're both local Malaysian developed. They're on Steam.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after that, there's just lots and lots of mobile games.
Yeah. And we're kind of seeing all the spread of mobile development all around the world. And I know I spoke with Rahul Sehgal from India a few months ago from Roach Interactive about developing Bird of Light and the... It's sort of the scene of the game industry in India at the time. And it is really fascinating. Again, as someone who has basically been stuck on the East Coast of the United States for so long, to be able to talk to developers like yourself and sort of get the worldwide view of what's going on.
Yes, yes. And mobile is definitely king.
Yes.
For sure. And the guy who, Sean Beck, who did Velocibox, mm-hmm. which I think is a fairly successful game on Steam. Mm-hmm. He his second game just came out, and that's mobile only.
Yeah.
So he went from PC to mobile.
Yeah.
And I think that's
And that common. Is a very interesting discussion about developers who make the move to mobile or go from mobile to PC and sort of how these markets differ. And I think that is definitely a topic too big to talk about in this cast, because we'll be here for like another hour and a half, I think, just talking about that.
Yes, yes. And then, of course, the different models. I spoke to a local, as an aside, a local mobile dev here who started out making premium games, so pay-in-advance games, as they were, and then couldn't really sustain it, was about to close up shop, went free-to-play, mm-hmm. and said, made no, an order of magnitude was the words he used, an order of magnitude more money, and could keep going.
Yeah. And that the mobile market is just very interesting to look at, especially as an older gamer myself who grew up on the console and PC side of things, and sort of how the mobile market has really captured almost a different segment of the consumer base.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. Let's see. I think, again, we could probably sit here and chat until it's probably nighttime for you, morning for me. But... just a few, I guess, general wrap-up questions, and then we'll say, I guess, good night or good afternoon for you. I guess going back to Concealed Intent then, so as of the time of this recording, the game will be due out next week. In terms of, for people listening to this cast, are you planning on releasing it to any other platforms? Is it going to remain, you know, exclusively on Steam? What is going on, I guess, on that front for the people listening to the cast?
Well, I've applied to go onto Humble, and actually just this morning I've got an email from them saying mm-hmm. to send them a load of data and keys. So okay. Hopefully it'll be on the Humble store,
mm-hmm.
Hopefully before it releases. Mm-hmm. I don't know how quick the process is.
Yeah.
After that, I don't know. I mean, I have to look at each store on its merits.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the actual figures, but I know roughly that much, much smaller than Steam. And most other stores...
I'm sorry, you kind of cut out. All I heard was much, much smaller than Steam.
Yeah, much, much smaller than Steam. And they also, the other stores, and also most of them have higher hurdle rates, so I need to sort of work out what would be appropriate. And Concealed Intent isn't a massive seller. I'm not going to be retiring on this money or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
so I need to have a look at them. I hope to have it on other stores. I'm going to email GOG and see. Is that how you say it, or GOG?
I've heard both. Really, I heard GOG and GOG.
I'll email them and see what they say. But I've heard they can be quite picky.
Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead.
I guess the other thing is for bundles. I don't know how the bundle stores how keen they are. Because I've said in public that I will not bundle Concealed Intent for a year until after release. Mm-hmm. So that's August next year is the very earliest it'll go in a bundle.
Yeah.
So I'll see about that as well.
Yeah, and the idea of bundling games, that's another newer thing to the game, and probably another hour-long discussion right there. But to sort of... But to like briefly, I guess, bring up here, it's definitely become a very interesting strategy for game developers. And it's one that, again, if you're not careful with, you know, how long you intend to really sell your game for, it can cause a lot of troubles, especially when you've just sold, you know, 10,000 copies of your game for maybe like 50 cents or a dollar or something like that.
Yeah, I've heard I've seen a lot of horror stories on Gamma Sutra, because then a lot of these end up on reseller sites too.
Definitely. And go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was saying we're hearing a lot more about sort of like the shady side of these reseller sites. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Lars Hussey of Level Up Labs, and we talked about the G2A tiny build argument that's going on right now.
Yes, that's a that's another. I listened to that podcast because I'm quite interested in it, obviously, and that's something else that. I mean, it's something else to consider when you go on a store. What are their fraud protection rights like? And I see just in the last couple of days, Humble has come out saying, you know, our fraud protection is safe. Don't worry about putting your game on our website.
Yeah,
it's definitely an issue you have to think about, because I mean, when you send you know, they these places ask for a lot of keys, and if you put it in a bundle, that's thousands of keys.
Mm-hmm.
So it can make a big difference. I mean, thousands of keys is hugely more than the game is sold in early access.
Yeah.
Massively, massively more.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could easily just swamp any demand for your game by selling it super cheap.
Definitely.
And that was one of the reasons. I mean, because I've had Humble haven't contacted me, but if they do, then I've certainly listened to them. But lots of other bundling places have sent me multiple emails asking me to go in their bundles.
Mm-hmm.
So I can imagine it's very easy to do. It's not something that if you want to be on most of these bundles as a developer, you don't need to do any work. They'll come to you.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a good idea to say, because I don't want to immediately devalue the game. I thought it a good idea to make a very public and explicit statement.
Mm-hmm.
About bundling, and we'll see if that's the right decision later. But I suspect, I greatly suspect that the demand for Concealed Intent as a bundle game will be exactly the same in a year's time as it is now. Because the impression is that people buy bundles because they're cheap, not because they're particularly supporting one of the games in the bundle.
Yeah, man, that is definitely the case, especially when we talk about like the mass market. I mean, when you look at buying the Humble Bundle, for instance, if you really think your dollar donation is going to help out the developer, that is just, you know, a fool's dream there. That dollar is split, you know, five or six different ways. And that kind of is an interesting point. Sort of about the educating the consumer on where their money goes when they purchase a game. And that may be a very interesting post topic or podcast topic down the line.
Yes, it's something that I wasn't aware of until I got the first response, you know, the first Steam report from. And there's also other various things. I know that other developers have problems with the US withholding tax as well.
Yeah,
especially if you're selling through Steam, which is something that they've never considered. It greatly impacts the amount of money they get from Steam.
Yep. Now, getting back to another part I wanted to ask you about with Concealed Intent. Earlier in this cast, you mentioned that you intend to continue working on the game after the release next week. Do you have any ideas or sort of like where you're going to take the game in hopefully the coming weeks or months of successful sales?
Yes, months of successful sales. That's what we're hoping for. Yeah, what I've said online and places is that for at least the 2 weeks after release, I'm not going to do any non-urgent work on Concealed Intent. So the first half of August, I'm just going to be available. I'm going to keep my source tree in a nice clean state in case a bug comes up, so I can fix it quickly and just roll it out quickly. After 2 weeks, I'll be a bit more comfortable and less scared of the possibility of a bad bug. Although I should say that I have greatly tested it over the last month already and with no new features. So I'm pretty comfortable and pretty confident that it's all great, but just in case. And then I'm going to spend a couple of weeks working on prototypes for new ideas. And then I'm going to go back and start working on a 1.1 release for Concealed Intent.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it'll be it probably won't be a huge release. It'll be any new features. I mean, a couple of people have come up with great ideas for little things to do. Mm-hmm. A couple of people have requested even more options under the skirmish generation, mm-hmm. which I'll definitely look at that. And I'd really like to add a few other things like support for Linux, which I'll have to look into. Mm-hmm. Support for, at the moment, the online play is deeply built into the Steam API. Mm-hmm. So if I want to make a non-DRM version, I'll have to pull all that out. So there's a non-DRM online play version, and that'll allow me to release a non-DRM version of the game. A couple of people have suggested extra missions, so I'll look at that. I mean, none of these are promises. They're all things that I'd like to do. Yeah. Oh, and the other people have asked about Steam turn notification, so the little pop-ups that appear when a turn arrives. So I'll have to look at the documentation for that as well. So there's certainly a lot of things I can look at doing. Mm-hmm. Most of them, I guess, there's nothing really nothing huge and fancy there that'll make a big difference to make it a vastly different game. It's more about, at least for 1.1, it'll be more about just adding nice to have features.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's always a challenge when you're building the game past release about how far and how much you are willing and able to do. And that's another area that we've seen developers tend to struggle with. They either, you know, completely overwhelm themselves, or they put too much in and just don't get the return on that investment.
Yeah, so that's a big thing. I've heard that people are more reluctant to buy things on early access. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to see a large bounce when I go into full release. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. I promised at least a 1.1 release, which will be at least a month's worth of work or 6 weeks' worth of coding work, which I can get based on what I've been doing. I know I can get quite a bit done in that time period. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it'll depend. I'll have to see.
Yeah, and it's always, I guess, the biggest factor, and the one we can't talk about right now, is just exactly how well the game's going to do on the market. That's unfortunately one thing that no matter how much we talk about, we just never know until day one or week one of release. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I've spoken to... Oh, go ahead. Were you about to say something?
Okay. One of the things I was thinking of doing was a month after release, mm-hmm. putting something up on Gamma Sutra. I can't put my actual figures up. That's not allowed by Steam's rules. But just putting up, for instance, like the first sort of level of analysis, like how many people bought the game compared to how many people visited the page, which, for instance, is now at the moment running at about, I think, 1 in 1,000. 1 in 1,000 people who look at the page on Steam would buy the game based on number of views, number of sales. And then also things like how many impressions on Steam resulted, how many sales. So I had to work that out to determine if getting advertising was worthwhile. I don't think it is at that rate of return. But that sort of information would be what's normal would be very useful to know. And just the comparison of what are the sales figures for early access compared to the sales figures for the first months after release? You know, how much of a bump do you actually see? I think that would be very useful information. So yeah. I do plan on putting that sort of information up on Gamma Sutra in what would be 6 weeks' time.
Yeah. I think that's going to be very interesting to look at. It actually goes back to a topic that I'm finding more and more that we're talking about, especially on these podcasts with Game Wisdom, is that a lot of this information about what goes into a game, especially the results on making a game, just aren't really laid out there for people to learn and understand. You mentioned a few minutes ago about trying to learn about, you know, where your money goes with Humble Bundles or with bundling in general. Like, this is all very important stuff to know, but it's just very hard to find a credible source of that information online.
Yeah, and if you look at there's a huge number of hints online, but there's people can't say exactly what it is. I'm technically not supposed to tell you how much of a percentage I pay after tax to Steam.
Yeah.
But if you look it up, if you put Steam's cut into Google, you will find you will find out exactly what people pay. Mm-hmm. It's like an open secret, but you're not really supposed to say. And as someone who's an indie, you absolutely are dependent on Steam.
Yes.
If there's the slightest possibility of me getting kicked off Steam, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, definitely.
that's like a instant indie death.
Yeah.
You have to make sure you're within the rules, mm-hmm. And that unfortunately does mean that a lot of this information is more hinted at than mm-hmm. than definite.
Definitely, and again, just so many topics we can really branch off with this conversation, and I would love to have you back on because again, we can talk about any one of these topics could be like another hour and a half of discussing we have on.
It's amazing how much I've learned over the last 4 years. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. someone who's been writing code since the mid '80s, mm-hmm. but there is so much I've learned about the sort of business side of things and the marketing side of things that was just completely I didn't know what I didn't know.
Yeah.
When I started.
Oh yeah, and I can say the same thing about doing Game Wisdom. I mean, the last 2 months, like you said earlier, you've said multiple times on this cast how the marketing side of things wasn't your specialty. I could say the same thing about me for the first, we could say going on 4 years of working on Game Wisdom, that the social side has escaped me. And then over the last 8 months, I've got heavily onto YouTube and Twitch. And over the last 3 months, I've gotten really big on social media with Twitter and doing more there. And it's, as you said, it's the things you don't know that can come back to really bite you when you're trying to do something like this.
Definitely, yes.
All right. And again, Charles, it has been fantastic talking to you tonight. I feel every time the cast goes over like an hour, I know that it's one of those discussions we could just chat for, an entire day if we were able to. We could just sit here and just talk.
Yes, definitely. And if you want me to, if you want to talk again sometime, then I'd be happy to do it.
Definitely. I'd love to have you back on. I'd love to have you on when my contributor James is on. I hope he didn't get washed away in the rain and the thunder that we had tonight.
Is he local to you as well?
He is in Pennsylvania, so he's I think he's like maybe mid or upper Pennsylvania, so not like extremely close. He's about like a state away, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but I do know he's definitely East Coast, so he got hit probably just as hard as I did.
Right.
So we'll see. Hopefully, by the time you're listening to this cast, he is all well and good, I hope.
All right. James, I hope you're fine.
Yeah. All right. Again, Charles, this has definitely been a great cast. I wish you the best of luck with Concealed at 10. Again, we're recording this 1 week before launch. So hopefully by the time you folks are listening to it, there'll be good news regarding how well the game is doing.
Yes, I think it's because one of the other things I learned is you have to launch during Valve's working day.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be, 8 a.m. on the 2nd of August, mm-hmm. Pacific Standard Time, which is unfortunately 11 p.m. here.
Yeah, and again, as we said earlier, when you're in this business, especially when you're doing international work, you need to learn the language of of time zones, or it's just never, it's an always losing battle sometimes.
Yes, find a good website. I'm always typing time zones into websites to try and work things out. Or what time is it in New York now?
I do the exact same thing, but the worst is when you type it in, you still get it wrong. Because I've had casts like that where we're off for like 3-4 hours. You said 4 o'clock Eastern. Oh, I meant 3 o'clock Mountain Time, European time plus 1 or 2. Like I've had a few guests in London that I've spoken to, and it's always fun when you're trying to figure out the right time zones.
Yes, daylight savings will always get you.
Yes. Again, I would definitely love to talk to you again, Charles, regarding just about anything that we've talked about tonight, and especially follow you more about how Concealed at 10 is doing. I feel like we were on the verge of having probably five or six different, like, 30-minute tangents over, like, the last hour and 40 minutes of recording.
Yes, it felt like a couple of times I was I was talking for a bit. I was hoping not to keep people interested.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's been great. We were only planning on talking for an hour, but I think for people listening to these casts, you know, whenever we say, you know, 40 minutes or an hour-long casting, it always goes over. And it generally goes over for the right reasons. We had so many great topics to talk about tonight. And, again, there's just so many interesting parts of game development that we can speak about.
Yes, yeah, it's been very very thought-provoking. There'll be a few things I'll have to think about as well.
Awesome. All right, so with all that said, we are going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you're interested in supporting Game Wisdom, there are multiple ways to do that. If you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. We are looking for anyone, be them students, enthusiasts, developers, as long as you're interested in talking about the industry, we'd love to have you on. Be sure to follow me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Blazer to get the latest updates of new content as well as thoughts from me throughout the day. You can find all my video content, including the video spotlight I did on Concealed Intent, over on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. There should be a link to that on the front page, and you can search for me there. On the YouTube channel, you'll find my variety of Let's Plays, video examinations, and more. Last but not least, you can support Game Wisdom through our Patreon campaign in order to get the monthly funding we need to keep going. You can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking the banner at the top of the front page. Any donations will be greatly appreciated. I really need to hit at least the first goal, as that would mean the world to me, as well as allow me to keep doing this. And as a last note, as I've said recently, we are doing a special shout-out to Patreon contributors who donate at least $20 or more. Donate at least $15 or more. So I would like to thank Danny Romnes for their donations at the time of this podcast recording. And if you would like to get a shout-out or a digital CD featuring this month's cast, you can find that on the Patreon. All right. Again, Charles, it has been an absolute pleasure talking with you tonight. And, yeah, definitely don't be a stranger. I would love to talk to you again, you know, whenever you have free time.
Thank you very much. I would love to talk as well.
Awesome. So, with everything said, thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will see you all again next time. Take care.